I was an economic hitman. My job particularly was to identify countries that had resources our corporations want, like oil. Today, more likely to be lithium, cobalt, some of the rare minerals that are necessary for the high-tech industry. And then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. The money didn't actually go to the country. It went to our own corporations in the United States to build big infrastructure projects in the country, things like power systems, electric power systems, industrial parks, highways, ports, airports, things that benefited a few very wealthy families in those countries, the families that own the industries, that own the banks, that own the commercial establishments. And as a result, GDP would increase. And so for many years, I thought I was doing the right thing because I could see that when you put this money in, GDP increases, and particularly GDP per capita. Mm-hmm. But it really isn't, because GDP does not measure how well most of the people are doing. It measures the wealthy particularly. But I didn't realize that for a long time. That was basically my job, was to convince these countries to take these huge loans, hire our corporations that made big profits off building the infrastructure. And in the end, the country couldn't repay the loans. And so we'd go back in and demand the pound of flesh.
John, can I call you John? Or
sure.
Would you prefer Mr. Perkins? Yeah? Okay.
No,
well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. And I think that this is actually probably one of the most opportunistic times that we have to talk to you because of everything going on with USAID right now, and that you have such a unique perspective that so many people do not have. I think there's a ton of confusion out there on really both sides of the political aisle, but then just Americans in general not familiar with what USAID does. And then, you know, there's a lot of obfuscation that goes on in the media as well about it, right? And so you have not just a great perspective, but you have a heavy history with it and can speak to the depths of it from actual field work, you know? And that's something I am really looking forward to hearing from you. But I would like to, you know, formally welcome you onto the podcast and say thank you for being here, and then also give you, would like to you to introduce yourself so people listening know who you are.
Yeah, so I'm John Perkins, and thank you for that introduction. I was an economic hitman. My real title was chief economist at a major consulting firm. But my job, and I had a staff of up to 50 people, my job particularly was to identify countries that had resources our corporations want, like oil. Today, more likely to be lithium, cobalt, some of the rare minerals that are necessary mm-hmm. for the high-tech industry, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. The money didn't actually go to the country. It went to our own corporations in the United States to build big infrastructure projects in the country, things like power systems, electric power systems, industrial parks, highways, ports, airports, things that benefited a few very wealthy families in those countries. The families that own the industries, that own the banks, that own the commercial establishments. And, you know, and as a result, GDP would increase. And so for many years, I thought I was doing the right thing because I could see that when you put this money in, GDP increases, and particularly GDP per capita, which sounds like it means that everybody, you know, per capita, well, that's the average citizen. But mm-hmm. it really isn't, because GDP does not measure how well most of the people are doing. It measures the wealthy particularly. And so GDP per capita is just how well the wealthy are doing divided by the population. But I didn't realize that for a long time. And so, you know, that was basically my job, was to convince these countries to take these huge loans, hire our corporations that made big profits off building the infrastructure. And in the end, the country couldn't repay the loans. And so we'd go back in and, you know, demand the pound of flesh, sell your resource, mm-hmm. oil, whatever, real cheap to our corporations. Let us build a military base on your soil. Vote with us on the next United Nations vote against Cuba or China or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if the heads of countries weren't willing to accept this, which was not very usual, actually, then we had people we call the jackals, which I think reflects some of the work you guys do, you know. Mm. And so, You know, the people that would go in and overthrow governments in coups or sometimes assassinate them. And I have to say, you know, I've known quite a few of these people. So when I said like the work you guys do, I didn't mean that as a reflection on your character, because I think most of the people that do that kind of work really believe in what they're doing for whatever reason, as I believed in what I was doing for most of the time. And if you finally see the light, then it's hard to get out, for that matter. But I just have deep admiration for a lot of the people. I have admiration for the jobs that sounds like you guys have been involved in. And we've often, all of us, not all of us, but majority of us are just, we're being lied to, and we're lying to ourselves, and we're lying to people in other countries. And but we don't know that we're lying, because we're lying to ourselves too. And the system is set up to convince us that we're doing the right thing, whether it's the economic hitmen or the jackals.
Yeah, that's a lot of heavy stuff in what you were just saying. And I think one of the most remarkable lines from your book that I remember that ties really well into what you were saying is the question got asked during a conversation you were having. It says, you said, or maybe somebody adjacent to you said that Texaco topples governments was a question that got asked. And I think that's pretty profound to ask that question, because it's not what you think of when you think of corporations and just how things work. And I know there's a lot more people that pay attention now, and they look into this stuff, and maybe it wouldn't surprise a lot of people, but I'm sure it would have surprised a lot of people back then. But to your point, you know, I would like to get into that and how that sort of the sausage is made and break down what these things mean, how you know, these jackals are involved in overthrowing governments, and you know, sort of the role of economic hitmen at large, especially in today's modern society, and then getting into just how these essentially this like octopus of money and debt makes its way around the world, and really is probably the biggest form of manipulation the globe has ever seen in history.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we've got China doing a more efficient job than we ever did.
Right.
I taught at an MBA program in China and realized from the very beginning that the reason I was there was because they wanted to hear about the mistakes I had made and the
That's really interesting.
I had, so they could do a better job, and they have. You know, they are. It's amazing how they're taking over the world. I've got a cool map. Well, I don't know whether you want to call it cool or not, but interesting. And you can see up in, and this is produced by the International Monetary Fund. And And up here you get the year 2000, when the United States was the number one trading partner with 80% of the countries in the world. Today, well, this is not 2020. It's gotten even more this way in the last 5 years. But China's just taken over, completely replaced us, especially in places like Africa and Latin America, all over Asia and Europe. You can see from the map, it's phenomenal.
It's a pretty stark way to look at that and paint that picture. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so they've got a different story to tell, a story that may be more attractive to the leaders of many countries. And their economic hitmen are very proficient at what they do.
Mm-hmm. You have a lot of really interesting stories in your book. I really enjoyed reading about your ventures there in like South America and all of the early, especially the early Cold War stuff that was going on. And I would encourage people to go and read about it. But I would be really interesting to hear any stories that you have that could really articulate how that process went. And then we could jump into like the modern age and then talk about what's going on right now behind the scenes, and then how China's EHM programs, as you say, the economic hitman programs, are more efficient. And I've seen it firsthand, and I know Chris has too, being deployed to Africa. I've seen the Chinese and how their presence there. They literally built a naval station right across from a U.S. naval station in Djibouti. You can see it, you know. And then in Kenya, there's another one that we were less than 5 clicks from. It's pretty remarkable how fast that's happened. But maybe we could do that just to sort of give this some form. Would love to hear more about your career, like some personal stories from you, so, you know, people can hear about you and learn about you, but and these processes that you went through, and then jump into the more modern time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask you a question first. So, you know,
absolutely.
From the information I get, the military base in Djibouti is a real military base, but what I hear is that in Kenya, it's kind of more a supply place and a maintenance operation. Does that jive with what you've actually experienced there?
Yes. So it's a large port that is adjacent to the area I was on along the Indian Ocean coast. And that's what it is commercial, but you know, everything they have, whether it's commercial or not, has the intention of being able to support a military presence as well. So is huge, is enormous. I mean, I'll say it, you know, I got to fly drones over it and spy on it and look at it and all this stuff, and seen a lot. You can go on Google Earth and look at it now. You used to not be able to, but it's huge. It's enormous, and the footprint they have there, we talk about this pretty often, and you did in your book as well. They come in and they build infrastructure, and they sort of work on the hearts and minds aspect of things, but they still have the same goals in mind as you so well articulated in your book. But their model is a much more warm and welcoming way, rather than the sort of iron fist way that the United States did, you know, foreign diplomacy, and has done foreign diplomacy for a long time. So it's, it is, I guess, more efficient nowadays, especially with the way the media is. But yeah. Yes, to answer your question, it's a more commercial port for sure.
Yeah, and you know, that's a very smart move on that part, I think, because we got over 100. I think it's around 170 military operations in over 100 mm-hmm. countries, and that causes resentment, as you guys know. and yet they do it in a way where maybe something similar is going on, but it's not. It's much more portrayed, as you said, like in Kenya, around trade. So it's perceived differently. And perception is everything. You know, my whole mm-hmm. job was around perception. And we know that perception molds reality. You know, perception, when we change our perceptions, we change our actions, and that changes the reality. And I think the Chinese are extremely good at using, at giving people a perception that they're doing something very, very differently. And in some respects, it True. Is different, but as you pointed out, it's with the same goal, and it's with the goal of being the number one dominating power in the world. And they're achieving that goal. I think, you know, the United States seems to be declining while China's inclining, and you know, that's something to really, really take a look at.
Mm-hmm. From my point, I think that it comes down to. So when you talk about the perception, when you know, and I got to say, like right up top, because I am active duty military, like any opinions that I give here are completely and totally my own. They don't represent the DOD, and I legally have to say this every time, and they don't represent any other entity within the United States government. But if you look at the way United States foreign policy is configured, it's very segmented. You have the military mm-hmm. arm of foreign policy, the economic arm, and these different branches are very, you know, segmented, and you know exactly who you're dealing with when you're dealing with them, versus underneath the Chinese Communist Party, because everything is the CCP. It may mm-hmm. be a businessman that it looks like you're dealing with on the surface, but because the CCP is one large organization and everything in China is controlled by the government, they look more amorphous. And I think that's one of the ways or where that perception, like you were talking about, sir, comes from, right? Because it looks like a businessman and he's here on behalf of such and such corporation out of Beijing, but when you dig into the financials, like who actually owns that corporation? Well, it is still the CCP, and they have a very, you know, they're very yeah. controlling over the business, and they decide where the business is going to go and who it, you know, who it conducts business with and so forth. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons that they've been so successful, because to them, when they say total war around the world, and it's part of their Belt and Road Initiative, like mm-hmm. the economy is a huge arm of that for them, and they understand. Mm-hmm. And to the Chinese mind, to defeat your enemy without ever having to fire a shot is the greatest art of warfare, Sun Tzu, mm-hmm. right? And so it's like when they're coming at it from that standpoint, you can see why maybe they're doing better than we have historically. At least that's my take on it. I'd love to get your opinion.
Well, yeah, Chris, I think you hit the nail on the head. And so you were in Africa with the special forces? So.
I was not in Africa, and I have not been. I've been to the Middle East, and I've been all over a bunch of Asia, but never have been to Africa. So,
Well, Yeah, but so you've seen this in the Middle East, and in, it's interesting that China has not gotten involved in wars in the Middle East the way we have mm-hmm. in Afghanistan and Iraq. They have not spent their resources on those kinds of wars. They've mm-hmm. spent their resources on developing trade, mm-hmm. as you said. And yeah, so the Chinese government owns 50% plus, at least 50% of all the big international corporations. And like you said, they don't even have to tax corporations because they get the money anyway, which is kind of a, you know, it's actually an amazingly smart system if you think about it. And it has its drawbacks, but it also, you know, whereas we've got all these corporations competing with each other, something you mentioned Texaco earlier, and mm-hmm. you know, you've got Texaco, which is now Chevron, competing with Shell or other
BP
oil companies, yeah. And yet, if you're a Chinese company, it may appear that you're competing somewhat with the other companies, but really you're all working together with the same goal. And, mm-hmm. and a large percent of your profit goes directly to the government.
Right. Yeah.
You don't need taxes.
It might be difficult to hear, but there's an argument to be made for the efficiency, I guess, that goes into there and an advantage that it does give the CCP in having, first off, a leader that has total continuity. You don't have to worry about changeover there, right? And then you have a constant upflow of information and manipulation and control over these enterprises. You know, this is a drum that we beat constantly on this podcast mm-hmm. about economic warfare. And then to your other point of perception around the world, because the perception, especially with the other half of the world, not our side of the world, not our hemisphere, is that China has won. Russia is winning as well. Like there's all of this. Even when I was in Africa talking to some of the Kenyans, they shared that opinion. And I even got razzed one time by one of the Kenyan Rangers about how, you know, the Kenyans, I'm so glad that we're aligning with the Chinese because, you know, you Americans, like, thanks for the, I was giving him a ride and he made a joke about it. He was like, thanks for the ride, you know? And it was just like kind of one of these, like, okay, you know, I said a few choice words up under my breath about it. And it's like, whatever, you know, but that's just the perception and the reality that which is the reality for these guys, the way they think and the way that they do business. But there is, as uncomfortable it is to say, there's an advantage there that they have because they do have total continuity and then total control, but that can also spiral out of control really fast too. And there's a lot of other reasons, as you as an economist would know, they have a more homogenous society as well, which is also easier for them. And then they also have civil military fusion, which they have a huge share over whatever happens innovation wise in the civilian industry automatically gets imprinted into, you know, the military. So there's not the competition there, like where Silicon Valley here in the United States can take a, you know, an issue with having to share that information or not wanting to because they don't want to see their innovation be used for warfare or killing people or whatever. So there's that conscientious objection that the, you know, Silicon Valley here in the United States can have where you don't have that option in China.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, China has an amazing story to tell. They had, they averaged about 10% economic growth for 30 years. Nobody else has ever done anything like that. And they, you know, they brought about 900 million people out of dire poverty, more than twice the population of the United States. And you know, if you're the president of Kenya, Nigeria, or Ecuador, or Peru, or wherever, and you hear a story like that, you may say, well, I don't want the Chinese government, the way the government operates, but I think the way they've developed their economy has a lot of merit to it. At the same time, the United States, it's, you know, and the Chinese will point out that our middle class has dropped from 60% to 50%. We still mm-hmm. we still have a federal minimum wage of what we had in the early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of states don't, you know, they have their own minimum wage, but I think there's like 30 states, I can't remember the number, but the official, and so, you know, the Chinese economic hitman goes in with those kinds of stories, and mm-hmm. it's very appealing. If you're the president of a country or the minister of finance, you sit up and listen to those stories.
Absolutely.
It's a pretty easy sell to look at another country, especially if they have something closer to a dictatorial style of government, and be like, would you rather rely on this American economy where you don't know who the administration is going to be in 4 years because the American government only thinks in 4 year spans, possibly mm-hmm. eight, or would you rather rely on, you know, the CCP, which thinks in 100 years at a time, because they really do, or even Russia mm-hmm. thinks in decades at a time because of that continuity. But then on the other side, right, like if I'm an American, you got to be thinking the continuity may not be there, but also the innovation and the speed at which the United States can produce things because of, you know, the way that capitalism allows for, you know, like I said, innovation and change and rapid right. expansion. You know, it's there are, and I'm just saying economically, a lot of people are going to get really mad at me in the comments really quick and be like, oh, Christopher suddenly pandering for socialism. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, economically speaking alone, right, you, there are certain pros and cons to it. And it you can see how it becomes an easy sell, I guess, for like mm-hmm. more dictatorial governments when you look at it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead, Brandon.
No, I was just going to say that I was hoping that we could segue into you. I know you gave a really good overview of what an economic hitman is, but if we could get into some of the weeds from some of your experiences on how these things play out, I know the audience would be really appreciative to hear about these things. We know, we read about them in your book, but you have a very intriguing way of painting that picture because you also espouse your own personal opinion to what was going on at the same time, which I thought was a really unique insight into that as well. It wasn't just a, you know, an oil derrick of information. I thought that was really, really cool that you did that. But I was wondering if you could sort of just surgically get in there and explain some of these things that you were talking about in your book.
Well, there's a lot. I don't know where to, mm-hmm. where to begin. There's very many different stories. So mm-hmm. you take a country like Indonesia, which is, I spent a lot of time in it. It was my first assignment, but I also went back many times. I had an office in Indonesia. And when I first went there, it was 1971. And, you know, I think the U.S. pretty much had realized that we'd lost Vietnam. And there was the domino theory that if Vietnam goes, then the rest of Southeast Asia eventually goes communist. Mm-hmm. And Indonesia was a key because Indonesia had just discovered a lot of oil and it has the largest Muslim population in the world. And it sits in a very strategic location. You know, it controls the traffic between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, and it's very strategic. So, you know, I was sent in to make sure that Indonesia did not go communist. And that was the job, was to, you know, to help them build up their economy and basically put them in debt to us to make that happen. And over the next 10 years, on and off, I was involved in Indonesia with various projects along those lines. And so that's one model where it was their resource of oil that we were after. And we had the money. They didn't have the money. We could develop the infrastructure. We could offer them these sorts of, with oil being the collateral. And that was the primary model that we worked off of in Africa and Latin America and throughout Asia. There was another model, though, which would pertain to countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, where I also spent a lot of time. I had an office in Iran also. And for 10 years, I was involved in and out of Iran. Iran didn't need our money. We couldn't convince them to take loans because they had the money. But what we wanted to convince Iran, as is true with Saudi Arabia, was that they needed to spend their money to hire us, their petrodollars to hire U.S. corporations. And again, the threat was, if you don't do that, Russia is going to come into Iran. Russia's right on the border with Iran, as we know. And so the fear of them going communist was driving that to then spend their money on us, so we would protect them. And of course, the argument that somebody like me would make was, if you've got a lot of American companies in here building power, electric power systems, and running the oil and building infrastructure, the U.S. military is right there too. If these companies get threatened to be overrun by some by Russian, or at that time it was Soviet Union military, we'll defend you. And not just because we're good guys who want to defend Iran, but also because we've got our own interests here that we need to defend. So those are two very different models. And in the most common one was the first one, where we wanted resources from countries that needed to take loans from us.
And could you get into
that answers your question or not, but
no, it does. I appreciate it.
Could you get into a little bit? I was fascinated about the section where you talked about how you were expected to give certain economic projections that were favorable for what you were doing. This topic really fascinated me, because we've been making the case on this podcast for a long time about how statistics are laundered into the public through like the mainstream media when the government needs popular support to do a thing, right? Then they will manufacture statistics which back up their argument, and then this is fed to the public in order to gin up this support. And you spoke about that in your book from the economic standpoint. Could you talk a little bit about that and how the building of the statistics, basically how you were fluffing the numbers on the ground in order to justify the investments at the corporate level?
Yes, it's a good point. So the World Bank, let's say the U.S. government in conjunction with the World Bank would decide that they wanted to put, I don't know, a whole lot of money, $10 billion, whatever, back the money's changed its value over the years, but a lot of money into Ecuador, because we wanted to keep Ecuador out of the red tide of communism that we said was threatening Latin America, and Ecuador had a lot of oil. Had just been discovered again, like Indonesia. So the World Bank comes to me and say, hey, we want to invest $10 billion or $100 billion, whatever dollars, in Ecuador. Can you convince the Ecuadorians to accept this as a loan that they can't pay back, but they've got the oil as collateral, and also determine what's the best thing to invest it in that American companies can build? Is it ports or airports or highways or electrical power systems? So then I would go in and basically I was a con artist. I talked to the presidents and the ministers of finance. I was not a very good economist, but even though I was the chief economist, I hired some people who were really good at working with statistics. and I would get them to justify the ends that I wanted to have. So I'd want to show, okay, so actually if you invest in the electric power system, and that system grows at 10% a year by us building power plants and transmission lines. Every year we build more and more and more, and then you get the system growing that way, then the economy is going to really take off. And instead of being at zero or less or 1%, I show you that. So from we'll develop econometric models that show you that the economy will now grow at 7 or 8%, just because we've invested in electricity. And really, those the guys who worked for me knew that they needed to come up with the right answers if they wanted bonuses, if they wanted promotions, if they wanted to continue working. And we paid very, very well. And it's interesting that people sometimes ask me, have other people written about this? Well, Joe Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize in economics and was chief economist at the World Bank, he says exactly the same thing. In one of his books, he talks about how we were driven by policy and to produce statistics that would support our policies. And, I think my books sold a lot more copies than his, because they're fun stories to read. And his books are read by academicians. Every PhD economics student or master's student has read Joe Stiglitz. But nobody else has, because they're not a lot of fun. But they've got that same information. And, you know, it was interesting because to make a simple example, and it would be much more complex, but a simple example of how this works is if you've got a graph and you're showing economic growth versus investments in electricity. And you show that, you know, you've got all these different, you may not have much information at all about the country you're working in, which for economists is a problem, because how do I develop a forecast if I don't have any history? Well, the way you do that is you look at other countries, and you look at countries where you've invested money in electricity, and you go along this graph, you've got the countries where you invest the most in electricity development, they're up here. The ones where nobody's invested, they're way down here. So you create this correlation. But, and I remember, you know, times when I wanted to show a certain number of economic growth that would occur if you invested so much in the electrical sector, and the guys didn't produce that number, the number I wanted. So I'd go in and say, well, what the hell's the matter here? Why didn't you? Well, they'd say this. So this country here, the Philippines or whatever, it's brought it way down. It's an exception. Skewing the, well, it's actually showing the right correlation, if you're really honest. But it's not what we want. And I'd say, well, okay, so give me some history of the Philippines and what happened in those years. And we'd always find something. Oh, there was a recession, there was a change of presidents, there was a coup, there was whatever. So you'd come up with justifications for throwing out the data that didn't fit the answer
it's just
you wanted to get. So Chris, it's a great question, and it's the manipulation, the lying of statistics, which has become such a huge and a part of our policy, but also the very idea that GDP measures how well a country is really doing. It doesn't. It measures how well a few people in that country are doing. And I'll give you an example. In the United States, let's say three people have as much wealth as half the country, okay? And I think now it's more like one. let's go with the three, because I've actually done the math on this.
There we go, okay.
As much wealth as the lower half of the United States, economically speaking. If those three people got 10% return on their wealth last year, and half the population lost 3%, and the rest of the population stayed the same, you would show an overall growth of almost 4%. So it would look like everybody's done better, where in fact only three people have done better. Only three people. And that's you can do back of the envelope calculations and see that's absolutely true. And if it's true just in a country where three people have as much wealth as half the population, what about a country where three families have as much wealth as 90% of the population?
Right.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's just so crazy to listen to this, to use your own word. I was going to say it too, but that essentially all this infrastructure and the information that makes its way back to the United States that gets filtered into the newspapers and for decades, like the America my parents grew up in reading all this stuff, right, is it's all built on lies. This infrastructure is just lies. None of it's actual reality. I mean, to your point too, you're almost rewriting history to justify doing certain things. And the other interesting thing about what you're saying is that like GDP is supposed to be like an output number, but the way you guys do it, it's like an input number. I mean, it's antithetical to what GDP is supposed to be, but it's just crazy to think of it that way, because it's all just air. There's no reality to it. It's crazy.
Yeah. So
is that fairly accurate to you said we were talking about the growth of the Chinese over the past couple decades, but that growth has sort of stalled a little bit over the past several years. It's not been as high. And we had another guest on here a while back who I use the term expert lightly for really anybody for the most part, but an expert on China, and talked about how the numbers for the Chinese GDP, especially over the last several years, have been fluff as well. Is this sort of the same model going over there where they're, you know, these targets they're trying to hit at the end of the year for GDP are actually just input numbers that they're saying they're hitting because they're skewing those statistics?
Well, yeah, I can't. I can't say for sure because I don't know how they do it, but
I
certainly suspect that to be the case. Mm-hmm. China's growth, they said it was 10% a year for 30 years, but it's certainly slowed down now.
Mm-hmm.
It's still growing at, you know, but it's growing at a much slower rate. But that's partly because it's a maturing economy. That does not necessarily indicate that they're going to mm-hmm. lose out. People
right.
cite that number as being, the Chinese economy is collapsing. No, it's become a mature economy. You can't have that kind of growth.
Mm. There's going to be a level out.
My wife and I get into these discussions. She's a lawyer, but also her dad is a retired Army general. So we have a little different perspectives on some of these things, she likes to point out that China has had such great growth rates because it came from nothing or less than nothing, which mm-hmm. is true, and it brought 900 million people out of poverty, but there was extreme poverty. Mao really screwed things up, the Cultural Revolution, and so
ordering people.
So yeah, it's easier in those early stages to have phenomenal growth, and then it levels off. But now they're at a point where they have a very mature economy, and they are technologically doing amazing things. Look at this new DeepSeek, the new
DeepSeek,
AI
their AI model
seems to be so much better than ChatGPT at this point. But you know, I like to see that. I think that's healthy competition because now it's being, ChatGPT and is being forced to really improve itself. And there's certainly great competition like that is helpful to all of us.
It definitely is helpful. The interesting thing about DeepSeek is both it and ChatGPT, which belongs to OpenAI, is what's called an LLM or a large language model. And the interesting thing about DeepSeek is, and when I say interesting, I just kind of use it ironically because it is so prototypical of what you see from China when it comes to the United States, but that what they do is something called AI stacking. And AI stacking is a way that you can train AI, and you have a bunch of different methods you can train AI, but first, they collect these semiconductors illegally through intermediary countries like Singapore, and they get them. And then they are also using the large language model from OpenAI to train DeepSeek, right? So it's interesting. I say all that to say that I don't necessarily agree that DeepSeek is better than ChatGPT because it was built on ChatGPT. But the competition piece, I totally agree with you about. And then the open source code for DeepSeek, which is different than what OpenAI was doing. And now you have Grok 3, and Grok 3 is its own application and all of this stuff. But that's the piece that I think is great. But I also think it's going to display where the more open way that we innovate here in the United States is superior. Personal opinion. I mean, if you have an opinion on that, I mean, I'd love to hear it. But that's just kind of the way I view that situation. But it is a very healthy thing to have that sort of competition.
Well, one of the things that I write a lot about these days is that these two countries, China and the United States, represent almost half the world's economy
mm-hmm.
and half the world's pollution. Almost half the world's pollution, and we're locked in this competition to create a more and more a death economy, an economic system that is in fact consuming and polluting itself towards self-destruction. It's based on short-term maximization of extreme materialism and short-term profits. And both countries are doing this. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that we can compete in ways that will take us into a life economy that is based on long-term benefits for all life and pays mm-hmm. people. To clean up pollution, corral all the plastic that's floating around in the oceans mm-hmm. and rejuvenate destroyed environments. Because I think, I have a 17-year-old grandson and mm-hmm. I often talk to him and think about what's he inheriting.
And, mm-hmm.
So it's really important that if somehow we can channel that competition into a competition to create products and technologies that actually lead to a life economy. That's my hope, and it's what I kind of devote a lot of my writing to these days. Mm-hmm. I often think when I was in high school, I I played tennis, and I was usually number two on the team. And to get to be number one, or to keep my position at number two, I had to play either number three or number one. Mm-hmm. And I played number one, and he was really good.
Yeah.
But every time I played against number one, he almost always beat me. But I improved my game, you know, because I got
exactly.
I had nothing to lose. You know, I could,
right.
I could hit the – I might against number three, I might do a little softer ball. I might not be quite as aggressive, but I just wanted to wear him out. I knew that he'd make mistakes. With number one, I had to slam. I had to really take some risks.
Right.
And so it was healthy.
Exactly.
We were in this competition. But when we played other schools, we would be on the same doubles team, number one and number two, him and me. And then what we had learned in competing with each other, we could combine to compete with the other team. And so, you know, this idea of competition, how do we use competition to make us all better? But in a way,
it's a great question.
We're going to ultimately be striving to create a world that our children and grandchildren will want to inherit.
No, I think that's a great question. And I would ask, are you familiar with the term Thucydides trap?
What is the term?
Thucydides trap?
No.
So a Thucydides trap is essentially an... what's an analogy, I guess, used to explain how when you have an existing power and then a rising power, and that they are in a natural competition for the top spot. So to your example about the one or two tennis player, right? And that eventually as they compete against one another, the new power enters that sphere to compete against the top power, that eventually that Thucydides trap is that they will compete against one another or go to war versus one another, and that there will be a winner. And that the trap is there's no way to get off that path once it's sort of begun. Does that make sense? So once there's that large power competition, right? And you could see where the United States-China thing fits into this. Do you think that there's a lot of we talk about this a lot about, you know, how do you find an exit from that? And you're talking about having the competition of technology and innovating and all of this and having a life economy, you know, thinking about it through the lens of a Thucydides trap and how it really says that eventually there's just going to be conflict and there's no way to avoid it. I mean, how do you think that we get to the point of having a healthy competition life economy, like you say, without going into some sort of absolutely devastating, globally devastating conflict?
That's the $1 trillion question.
Yeah. No doubt.
It's scary. I think it's, you know, it's very scary. And frankly, I think the current administration in the United States is making it more scary. And you know, whether you voted for Trump or didn't, I think at this point, my most recent newsletter said Trump loves China, because I think China is doing everything it can to change, to use a perception of Trump as a way to move more deeply into taking over the world, you know, things like the threat of an invasion of Panama. Well, I just came back from Ecuador, and I'm headed to Guatemala in a month, and I know, and I talked to leaders there, and they're like, "Oh my God, you know, if the United States is going to attack Panama, we need China here to defend us."
Really?
And that's unfortunate, and it's scary, and. So I am concerned, and I think, I don't know about Xi. I just don't know about Xi Jinping, what his mentality is as far as this is concerned.
It's hard to tell.
He's going with this, but yeah, as you pointed out, that trap that countries get into, and historically we've seen it over and over again. We managed to avoid it with the Soviet Union. I mean, that was the fear then, too. These two nuclear powers would push each other so far that they would go to war. They didn't. But
you put a really good thought in my head here. I think the deterrence there and the difference between previous Thucydides traps, right? Let's look at like World War One, right? The rising power of Germany in a Central Europe, right? And that sort of led Europe down this path of going to war because Germany, you know, basically just needed elbow room in their mind, and they did a bunch of things, right? But the deterrent in the Cold War was the nuclear weapon, right? What is the modern version of that deterrent that prevents this sort of conflict? What's the modern nuclear weapon, right? That's just an interesting thought. Yeah, I mean, we can hypothetical that all day, I guess.
It's still there, as we're mm-hmm. very aware. We're very aware with Iran. We're worried about North Korea. We're worried about China. And yeah. so I think the nuclear deterrent is still there, mm-hmm. although we've certainly downplayed it. Nobody's
right
under their desk to you know, in grade yeah. school like I did.
Duck and cover, yeah.
Duck and cover.
Yeah.
How foolish was that?
Anyway, all right. Just die under your desk, you know?
And so perhaps in a way it's more dangerous now because we're not talking about it very much. It doesn't seem as though we're, and yet we know, you know, if you read these things that saw a documentary recently about how close we came at times because I can't remember the details anymore, but it was somebody in the U.S. military who they're looking at a radar of, or whatever the, whatever the technology was, and they're seeing something coming in over Greenland from someplace, from Russia, from the Soviet Union, and they're thinking they got to pull the trigger, they got to shoot this thing down, and it turns out that the guy sitting behind the computer was, thank God, said, no, I don't think that's true, there's no reason to believe this. And it turned out it was, I think, clouds, you know, that it picked up. And apparently there's a similar
what we call a whoopsie.
Of something similar that happened on a Russian submarine where they saw
correct.
Something.
Correct. The submarine officer refused to fire, yeah.
Yeah. And so we've come so close to disaster, and thank God for individuals, for the Soviet individual and American individual who
no doubt
made the right decisions. But what if they hadn't?
Exactly. No, absolutely.
But we talk about that enough, frankly. I think that ought to be out there a lot more so that it would be a deterrent, as it was during the Cold War.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. The U.S. just fired an ICBM from Vandenberg either yesterday or the day before. And, you know, still showing that deterrence, like you said, the idea of first strike capability, I think the United States and China are competing against because of the difference between hypersonic ICBMs. And when I say hypersonic, I don't mean reentry vehicles. I mean actual, like, hypersonic engine, like scramjet style engine. So there's like the United States says they don't want to invest in it because it's like, if we all fire our missiles, it doesn't matter if yours hit mine lands 7 seconds before mine hit yours, we're all dead anyway, so it's a waste of money. It's more just like something cool to say and put out there, to your point earlier about perception. But no, it isn't talked about enough, and I almost don't think that economic deterrence is enough either. Because there's always been somebody saying, like, to go back to World War One, the conversation, there was even a book written, I wish I could remember the name of the book, but it basically postulated that because of the interconnectedness and the Industrial Revolution that took place in Europe, that Europe would never see war on the scale that they saw the Franco-Prussian War happen. And then obviously it happened, right? You know, Gavrilo Princip shoots Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, and then you got World War One, right? So the economic interdependence thing doesn't necessarily pan out as a solution. And there's a lot of other examples too. So it is like, you're to your point, like, to discussing deterrence is actually a great form of deterrence. It's an escalation of force to discuss things as well, which is an interesting way to look at it along like a force spectrum.
Yeah. So maybe we should reinstitute duck and cover.
There you go. Yeah. Get it in elementary schools tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris. I think to answer your postulation, Brandon, I would say that the new age nuclear weapon is AI and quantum computing.
And I
think that we're in a, like, this is our generation's Cold War, specifically looking at between us and China, because we really are in a race to control this technology right now. And whoever gets to the top of the, you know, and cracks the quantum computing nut, that represents the top of the pile. But I would like to shift topics just a little bit, if you don't mind.
No, John, yeah,
this is kind of like digging back into your experience, but asking you a hypothetical at the same time. I think that it took a lot of integrity and courage on your part to basically do the tell-all, especially when you looked back at your career and, you know, you admitted, you know, I was making economic projections based on what was expected of me, not based on what the facts actually supported or what would have been like an actual pure study. And you said that you had a large staff that worked underneath of you that was, you know, completely understood the assignment, as it were, to give you projections that supported, you know, getting the cart way before the horse, as it were. If that's happening in the economic sector, zooming out and then looking at, say, like the energy sector or, you know, construction or finance, you know, how much can we expect inside of our expert class that all of the data that we're being fed is not think tanks, you know, giving us or searching for facts that only suit their theories and not basing their theories on what the facts actually present? What would you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. And I guess that also addresses what you said earlier, that hopefully AI will be smart enough to actually, you know, if it can be designed to be objective. And let's say that I guess is a hope of mine, again, is that people, whether they're Chinese or Russian or Americans, will accept what comes out of that quantum computer
that's a really good point
is working on inventing, and apparently we're getting closer.
Right.
But you know, and if people could accept that machine that has the ability to really forecast what's going to happen, and it forecasts that if we stay on this trajectory, we're going to, by a certain year, self-destruct, that, you know, the economy will just blow up, or there'll be a war, or something's going to happen. And basically we'll end the world as we know it, and probably some human beings will survive, some of the animals will survive, or whatever, but it'll end as we know it. And if you could have an AI or a system that actually predicted this and everybody believed it, that would be a great answer. And
yeah,
other than that, I don't know. I really don't know. I'm, you know, it's easy to be discouraged. But on the other hand, I've been a martial artist most of my life. And, you know, I know that if I'm facing someone who's bigger and stronger than me, I don't try to overpower him. I have to use his energy against him. I have to be smarter. I have to make him move in big circles around me as I move in little circles, and so on. And, you know, I think we're at a time like that now where, rather than be discouraged, we need to just really, really look at how do we use for this energy. And in a country like the United States, where there's so much divisiveness today, how do we confront that in a way that will allow us to use the energy from all of this to a more positive result? And I don't have an answer. I keep exploring it, but I think that raising that question is an important one. How do we move into this more consciousness? But I also take hope in the fact that I travel around the world a lot. I recently was in Qatar, I was in Mexico, all over. I do a lot of podcasts. Earlier today, I did a podcast out of South Africa with a guy. One person was in South Africa.
And another, oh, wow.
And another one was in England. And, you know, everywhere, people are waking up to the fact that we're on a trajectory that's not a good one. That
absolutely.
We're headed toward, you know, self-destruction of the world as we know it. We're not going to destroy the planet. We're not going to probably even end all human life, but we'll change things. And I think that the fact that people are waking up to this and changing their perception to perceive the problem. Now the question is, how do we get them to take action? And I think you guys, having a program like this and continuing to discuss this, and I think the fact that the experiences you've had in the military, your background brings a lot of credibility to this, and I think, you know, which is really, really important at this point in history, to bring that knowledge that you have, the credibility that comes out of that, and the wisdom that comes out of the experiences you've had.
Do you believe at this point, with your vast treasure trove of experience, that the integrity of our institutions are beyond repair at this point? Do you think they've squandered all of their credibility?
No, I don't believe that, and I don't want to believe that. And
it's a scary thought.
I talked to my father-in-law the other day, who, as I mentioned, is a retired Army general. And I said, you know, so what happens if we end up in the United States at some point with a government that really is trying to have a coup and not have elections? What does the military do? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, and he said, there's a lot of really good people in the military at all levels who have a tremendous they're very conscientious people, and they have consciences. And he said, I most of those people would stop that. They would fall back on the Constitution, the fact that the commander in chief would tell them to do such a thing. You know, they know there's a law in there that says you don't obey your superiors if they're breaking the law.
Unlawful orders. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but he said, I also know that there's some bad eggs in there, and as there are in every aspect of life. And if that leader of the country were to elevate those bad leaders to the Joint Chief, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and of the other powers, then we get trouble. But we've got to believe that that's not what would happen, that the system would work. And, you know, we've got, and people complain about the Supreme Court, but I think when push comes to shove, I've got to believe that the Supreme Court ultimately will come down on the side of the law, especially in any really big issues that come up. So, maybe it's a blind belief, Chris, but I still have faith in our institutions. I have faith in our people. And you know, it keeps me going. But it also is really important for us to speak out, because so many people are so misinformed or just not informed at all. That you know, it's really, really important to bring this out. And I think you guys, with your backgrounds, you know, there's a lot of people in the military that need to hear all of these different sides to arguments, and then they can make their own decisions. But you know, we've got to be careful that people don't just get the good soldier perception of you got to obey orders no matter what. They don't, as you guys know.
It's actually against the UCMJ to follow unlawful orders. There's a protection that's baked into the UCMJ for that. And those reasons, it's no longer acceptable to say, I was just following orders, which is to use an example from the global war on terror. Those guys at Guantanamo Bay were trying to say that, oh, well, this Navy master at arms was instructing us to do these things to the inmates there at Guantanamo, and that excuse didn't work for them. Right. Well, so this safety's Abu Ghraib as well. Yeah, absolutely. This is examples of that system working, which is bolsters that hope that you're talking about, that those institutions still have the functionality to work sometimes, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, it's hopeful to see that.
I got to say, it's 8 after the hour. I got to get off at 15 after the hour, but I'm so enjoying this conversation. Maybe we can continue it another time. I think it's important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not against tariffs, especially if we impose tariffs on things that are produced socially or environmentally bad. I think that's where this tariff should be. But I think this idea of slapping an overall tariff on other countries, especially China, is a problem. I think it's really going to help China, because all of China's products are going to become much cheaper vis-a-vis American products all over the world, except perhaps in the United States. Now, in the United States, it's going to be cheaper to buy American than Chinese, but everywhere else, because the cost of our products will go up everywhere, that it gives a huge advantage to China. And so, you know, I think it's a big mistake to just have across the board tariffs. I'm not against tariffs per se, but I think, you know, just blindly imposing tariffs, and when we're certainly pissing off Canada and Mexico and threatening to do the same thing in Europe, that's not good. There's an ancient Chinese proverb that says, if you want to build an empire, make friends, not enemies. Yeah, I think it's a good proverb to be expounding right now. And we've been talking about it. I think China really kind of buys into that. It is a Chinese proverb, but I think, you know, they're buying into it. We need to make more friends and fewer enemies.
I think that there's a hope. Like, let's talk, if I could just real fast, talk about like the Europe thing that you're talking about, because it gave me an idea from like early Roman history, right? So this idea that the Americans are sort of yanking the rug out from underneath the Europeans, money, you know, defense aid, all of these things, is really in an attempt to get them to do things on their own and stand up for themselves, and the hopes eventually this will, you know, A, put on display that there's a mutual enemy that we need you to stand up and be capable of fighting alongside us, and that you'll recognize that and take action to do those things. And that a stronger Europe means that the preservation of the West is also bastioned by having that alongside the United States, right? And so the idea that I was talking about before of like early Roman history, where like a mutual enemy comes together, even though something a wrong was committed to them, right, makes me think of the early Roman history story of the Sabines, right? Where the early Romans went and they stole all these women from the Sabines. They did it at a feast, and it was a very, very big wrong that they did to them, right? But eventually the Sabines, I mean, after, and this is, and I'm very generalizing the story here, right? Okay. But that eventually the Sabines realized that there was more mutual benefit, despite the wrong, to join together with the early Romans, and then kind of let that go in the hopes of being stronger together. Like, do you think that actually, that sort of imprinted over what's going on in Europe today, actually has the opportunity to pan out that way in a modern society?
Well, first of all, I think it's very healthy that Europe is being pressured to put more of its own money into defense, mm-hmm. and to build up its own defense system. I think maybe the United States has been suckered a little bit into taking too much of that. But and it also is just damn good economics, because we got to understand that a lot of that money that Europe is going to spend is going to buy U.S. equipment. And of course, the other side of it is, when we put money into NATO, NATO did buy U.S. equipment. So it wasn't entirely a one-way street of us just giving them money. A lot of it came back. But now we're saying to Europe, well, you build up your system, which I think is very important. But also, it's going to bring money back to the United States in the form of buying U.S. equipment.
For sure.
So, yeah. So I think that you've got a good point there. That and I think most Europeans, I don't know, the ones I talk to, are not upset by this. They understand that it is their responsibility, and they're terrified right now of Russia and what's going on in Ukraine, and so they understand the need to build up the European system better. So I think ultimately that's probably a good thing.
I'm so glad you said that, because I have a great friend who is German. I worked with him. Him and I did law enforcement together there in Germany. And I've asked him a lot of these questions. I asked, to know like the European perspective, particularly, getting the German perspective, right, which is a microcosm of the European perspective. But he said the same thing that you're talking about, that he agrees, like they need to take more action. They need to stand up. They need to, sort of get rid of some of this ideology that's eroding their culture there as well. And be a European Union, I agree. I think we should definitely make this a part two, because I have really enjoyed this conversation with you. And I would also like to, at another time, really get into USAID's role and how economic hitmen perpetrate their aims, right? And then I have some other questions too. I also think it's really neat that you knew Howard Zinn. I think that would love to hear about that relationship. Let's make this a part two, John. Thank you so much for talking to us this time. We'll schedule that offline and get you back on.
Great. I appreciate it. All that you guys are doing.
Yeah.
Deeply appreciated. And so, I look forward to the next time.
Absolutely.
We'll set that up in the email.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and for my part, you know, anybody that watches this channel is going to recognize that you have vastly different perspectives than we do on a lot of this, but I really appreciate getting down getting to sit down with you and learning from your experience, because I think that these types of conversations that we have like this is where like the real learning happens, and
no
and
dogmatic thinking. People,
exactly. And, yeah. and I hope that some people are challenged a little bit on their thinking about economic issues, mm-hmm. especially as foreign policy is concerned, because it's a hot topic issue right now.
I totally absolutely. Agree with you, Chris. Yeah, absolutely. I have enjoyed it. And I always learn from these conversations. I think
me too.
That's part of what democracy is all about. You know, you, mm-hmm. you got to question everything.
That's why
you got to question everything, and especially look for things that you do wrong so that you can correct them. And that's always been one of my motivating goals of writing things, that sometimes people say, well, you're anti-American. You write about, you expose things. And I'm like, no, but
right.
the things that we've made mistakes and the Chinese are taking advantage of them. And the only way we're going to correct
exactly.
the mistakes is to expose them.
It's so good to hear you say that. The last thing I'll say is, you're right. Discourse and democracy go hand in hand. That's why the First Amendment is so important. So, yeah. But thank you so much for the conversation, John. We'll get part two going, and you guys have a good night.
Look forward to it. Yeah. Good night.